I'd like to welcome everyone to the next episode of Two Men in a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle. My name is Jamie Sanchez, and again, I'm joined by Pastor Bob Brandon as we kick off our next book.
Yeah, we're at a milestone. You know, yeah. Genesis is it's a huge book. 50 chapters, that's a large portion of the scriptures right there, and it's, you know, Genesis is so foundational, as we've said all the way through. Exodus is just as big.
Well, and the importance, you know, several years back, Bob, I couldn't have put the importance into words, but in becoming a reader of the text and really doing my best to understand what's being put down, it's really eye-opening to start understanding how important that knowledge of the beginning really is.
It carries all the way through, and we're going to see that in Exodus sharply. We'll see our major theme, as we call it, you know, the cosmic battle, mm-hmm. right away in this book. And so we'll explore that theme and have fun with that. We'll just have a great time tonight in the Word.
Well, and on the subject of themes, as readers, what should we be looking for? What should we be aware of? Are there any things that you would say from the...
Well, I would. There's lots of things. The first thing we've got to be aware of is the historical situation. There's tremendous debate surrounding the book of Exodus concerning historical questions like, who was this Pharaoh? Because we have a fair amount that has survived in history, mm-hmm. From Egypt. And we can look at their king list, and we can see who was king. And you look at that, you know, which one was it? You know, from within the world of the Bible itself, we would date this as you heard me date Genesis to about 1450 BC. There are direct statements in the scriptures, you know, that we built the temple 480 years after we left Egypt. So you just do the math, and you know, it's going to come out to about 1450 or so. But we don't really have any evidence of this, of the Exodus, in Egyptian history. So that makes scholars wonder. And I would just caution people, you know, don't be too concerned with what the scholars think. You know, there's just not always as much evidence as we would like. So when they're drawing conclusions, it's often from looking at, you know, a small fraction of the piece of the pie that was really there. Mm-hmm. So they're not always right, not because they're dumb, it's just we don't have enough evidence. So I think the Exodus was about 1450 BC. There's not really historical evidence outside of the Bible itself that would strongly favor or disfavor that one way or the other. Here's a little caveat about that, though, which is an interesting point, is that most ancient Near Eastern cultures don't record their defeats. You know,
well, it makes
it's
sense.
Like the Klingons on Star Trek or something. When they get defeated, they just don't say anything about that. They only write about their victories. So
Boston Celtics don't hang a banner when they lose the championship.
Well, that's
right?
A great way to say it. They only hang it when they win it. You know, so. Yeah, Egypt's not going to be too thrilled about writing down, yeah, we got annihilated by a bunch of slaves. Okay, they're not going to make a big statement about that.
Whose God was stronger than our gods.
That's right. So, however, there's another side to that coin. There is a nation in the ancient Near East that does record their defeats, and that's Israel. And they're the only one that does that. And there's a reason for that. Because God's writing their history, and He wants you to know when they were defeated and why.
And why, right.
So, but they're the only nation that records their defeat. So on the one hand, it's not really surprising that there's not a ton of evidence for this in raw history. So
a lot of, in Exodus, we're going to get a lot of deliverance. We're going to get a lot of... the birth of a nation.
The birth of a nation is a great way to say it. But yeah, back to your original question, the things that we should be looking for are all the things that are in narrative. that characterize narrative literature. So there's character development, there's point of view, there's direct speech, there's naming, there's repetition, there's irony, all those types of things. Mm-hmm. That's how you learn the story. We saw those things in Genesis, and now and then I'm remiss about pointing those out, but that's how to read the story. That's how you become a reader of the text. And we'll see some of those right off the bat. So maybe the best way, Jamie, unless you have another question, is our habit, why don't we dive in and read? We'll start at Exodus chapter 1. It's really not that long of a chapter, so I'll just read this straight through, okay. And then we'll go back and pick up the things we need to. Now, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number. But Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful, and increased greatly, and multiplied, and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Python and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shipra, and the other was named Puah. And he said, "When you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth, and see them upon the birth stool, if it's a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God, did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing, and let the boys live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them." So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive."
So, in between Genesis and Joseph and that time frame that we just finished, you know, discussing and learning about in Book of Genesis, how much time is
it's
elapsed?
About 400 years.
About 400 years in between
right.
Then and now.
Yeah, it would be 400 to 430. There's a direct statement in the scriptures, I think, to the 430.
And as Moses is putting down the names, the genealogy, yeah. Is that what's the reason to remind us of that?
To link it with they're separate books.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have been on different scrolls, and he's linking it to the Genesis account.
Now, question for you. So, I'm not Jewish. Why is it important for me as a reader of the Bible to learn the Israelite history? Because that's what, in reading and preparing for tonight, it really, I see that's what I'm going to get a lot of is...
Well, there could be a lot of answers to that question. The one that comes immediately to mind is along these lines. As you complete the whole story,
mm-hmm.
as you read through the whole Bible, you realize Paul picks this up in Romans strongly that when you said you're not Jewish, there's a sense in which you are. In a
right.
in the sense is, Paul uses the metaphor of a tree. He says, you Gentiles have been grafted in to the Jewish olive tree, right? Those branches have been cut off because of their unbelief, but you've been grafted in. You're in their tree. So in one sense, this is our family history.
Mm-hmm.
We are the children of Abraham by faith, right? Remember, mm-hmm. you know, God showing Abraham the stars, you know, this is how many children you're going to have. And as the story unfolds, he's talking not just about Abraham's physical descendants, but more than that, he's talking about his spiritual descendants. So there's a sense in which you could say, you know, with quotation marks,
right.
you are Jewish. This is your story. So when I read this, it's like I've been adopted into a family, and I'm reading about my family's history, and I want to know that because God's the father of this family. He's going to say in a chapter or so here coming up, you know, Israel is my firstborn, implying a couple things. One, it's his family, mm-hmm. but two, it's Israel's firstborn. There's other born, right? But all in the same household. So I feel like I'm reading my own family's history. But there's another side of that coin in that the Exodus is such a paradigm, such an example of salvation that you're really reading about, like you said earlier, you know, the birth of a nation. You get to the New Testament and it's called being born again when you come to faith. So it's a great picture of salvation. So hugely important book.
Yeah, and it seems to me the more I immerse myself in the Word, how important the Old Testament is, you know, whereas before any reading of the Bible I ever did was all New Testament. You know, this Old Testament quote-unquote stuff, you know, just didn't make sense to me. I didn't find the application in today's life and in what I was going through today. But I think if you know, our listeners could take away what you just explained, that understanding that ultimately in this truth we are grafted into God's chosen
That's right.
people.
Into his family. That's right. This is our story.
Now the sons of Israel, obviously blessed, you know, as it's talking about them, they fruitful and multiplied. Were they aware of that blessing?
Well, I don't know. The text doesn't make a statement about that, what they're thinking. But you could see me smile mm-hmm. as you were starting to say that, because you are becoming a really good reader. Now, where did you hear that before? Be fruitful and multiply. That's Genesis 1, right? That's the original mandate to mankind. And that's very much what Moses wants you to think as a reader. This is plan A. God's kingdom is happening. It's expanding. You remember how we described, you know, the job, the task for the priest kings, Adam and Eve, and the what we call the Garden of Eden, you know, God's kingdom at that point, you know, expand this thing, multiply and take over the whole earth. And they are doing that. God is blessing them in Egypt a lot. There's so much, it's scaring Pharaoh.
Scaring him. He's more than concerned.
You know, these guys are breeding like rabbits here.
Mm-hmm.
They outnumber us, and I doubt if they did.
Right.
Seriously doubt that. But he's concerned.
Right.
Right? He's concerned about a fifth column. And Egypt did have to worry about that. People would often come to stay in Egypt because they had such an abundant supply of food because of the way the Nile River works. So they had lots of different people groups living in Egypt. And he's looking around going, you know, if somebody attacks us, and if they side with
the
them,
others.
We have a fifth column. So, you know, they've got a fifth column inside their nation. They would be very vulnerable. So I understand their concerns,
right.
Pharaoh's concerns. But, I mean, Pharaoh's going to be a monster, and he's going to show that. But that's what's concerning him.
And no real, I didn't get any sense that there was, at this point in the story, there's not a real leader out of this whole group of people that's, you know, this whole...
Out of Israel. Yeah, that's right.
That is really being identified at this point. And that's... No. That's
and what it, made, but it's preparing for one.
Right.
One as big as there's ever been. Outside of Jesus, Moses is...
Right.
I don't know how to say it because you want to be respectful to our forefathers in the faith, but I mean, Moses is as big as you get. You got Abraham, you got Moses.
Yeah.
Boy, outside of Jesus, you really don't get any bigger than that.
That's what made me wonder whether or not the Israelites knew of this covenant, if they knew that story, if they knew who they were as a people yet, or is that Moses is
and,
really...
And that's almost impossible to answer. I don't know what they would have known at this point. After the Exodus, they would know what you and I know. You know, they'd know Genesis and Exodus, the books that Moses is writing. Before, I'm not sure how much they knew.
And we've been talking a lot about the seed of the serpent, seed of the woman. Am I seeing
this
right?
Did you see any of that?
Oh, yeah.
In this, okay, where did you see that? Because it is in there.
Well, you see, seed of the woman, I saw it immediately just as
okay,
they were
that's
going
Israel.
Through the...
Yeah, that's right.
Through the genealogy.
That's exactly right. And then how about the seed of the serpent?
Pharaoh.
Okay, what about Pharaoh? Because I'm looking for something specific.
Hardened heart?
not, that's coming down the pipe, but look at this word. Let's see. Where it says something to the effect... Oh, here it is in verse 10. This is Pharaoh speaking. Come, let us deal wisely with them. That word is really the word, the NIV does a better job on that word than the New American Standard. We typically read from the New American Standard, but the NIV is better there. And it says, let us deal craftily with them. Literally, it says that. Now, the last time, maybe not the last time, but the first time we saw that word,
well,
it was
serpent.
The serpent, saying the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field. So here's Pharaoh, you know, direct speech, his own words, let us deal craftily with them. So that's how you become a reader of the text. You pick up on the repetition. It's a very common way in Hebrew narrative for them to make their points, for them to develop their themes, is they repeat words.
And even in this sense, almost an unknowing seed of the serpent, in a sense, you know, because of their own gods, you know, I kind of got a sense of that yeah, it definitely was tracking the seed of the serpent, but not as blatant as some of the earlier.
Yeah, perhaps, but still, right there.
Oh yeah,
and in the context of them fulfilling Plan A, right, multiplying and subduing the earth. And here comes, you know, Pharaoh, let's be crafty with this people. Now, imagine this, too. If you were to, let me make two other points. So if I go too long on one, say, hey, Bob, you were going to say something else, too. Okay. Because I always forget my second point. But the first point, if you were actually to visualize Pharaoh, I've got some books I could show you, you know, what that would look like. But Egypt was an amazing culture. And on that big crown kind of thing they would wear, there's a serpent on that crown, right? That's what protects Pharaoh, you know, from the underworld and so on. So,
top of their staffs?
Well, that perhaps, but I know for certain on their, you know, right on their forehead. So a Hebrew, you know, reading this at this time has that picture in his mind of that serpent, even as he thinks about Pharaoh. The second point is, which ties in with how we introduced tonight, we don't really know in history which Pharaoh this was. He's not named in the text. Okay, does Moses know who the guy is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, he grew up in his household.
Right.
We're going to see that in the next chapter, right? Moses, well, that Pharaoh died and this is a new one, but Moses knows him.
Right.
Knows him personally. Not even just, you know, like you and I might recognize our president if we saw him somewhere. Hey, that's Barack Obama. But we don't really know him. See, Moses would actually know this guy. So he knows his name. And he never listens. It's just Pharaoh. It's not the guy's name, right? And then in the second half of this first chapter, you have these two Hebrew midwives. What is their rank compared to Pharaoh? Pharaoh's the most powerful guy on earth at this time.
And,
here's these two men, and they get named, right? Pharaoh, no name. I mean, it's, you know, Moses' subtle slam on, you don't even rank enough to be named.
Gotcha.
Right? But these two midwives, I'm going to tell everybody their name. Down through history, we know who these two women were, and we don't know who the Pharaoh was. Right.
Interesting. I hadn't even really thought of that, but you know, it's definitely, you know, one of the first attempts to rid the planet of the Israelites.
Oh yeah, that's right. And also then looking way forward in the story, this happens again when Jesus is born, right? King Herod is gonna try to kill all the children. Right, so that's why I say this story is our story.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely, and it is. It's important to realize that as you pointed out, we were grafted into the tree, and it's important for us to understand this base knowledge.
That's right. In all the details in the text, though, we have said that we don't really have historical verification of this. Outside of the scriptures, but it's all very Egyptian. All the details fit very much with the time that we would describe as about 1450 BC in Egypt. All these, like building these storage cities, that's exactly what they were doing at that time. So all the details in the text definitely fit that historical period.
Well, and as it referenced, the midwives, right, they were Israelites.
They're Israelites.
And it's, they feared God. So somewhere...
Yeah, that's huge. That's a huge point.
Somewhere somebody's got to be teaching.
Yeah, it's not the case that they have no knowledge of God.
Right.
Yeah, they have enough to know, don't be doing that.
Right.
That's
and,
right.
And disobeyed Pharaoh and...
The whole thing is kind of puzzling, because you're like, why would you... If you were Pharaoh, why would you even expect them to obey you?
Mm-hmm.
You think these Hebrew midwives are going to kill their own children?
Right.
Because you told them to? No way. And then I can't believe he's kind of bites on their, oh, well, we can't get there fast enough, you know. These are strong women. Our softies, Egyptians, you know, they're hanging out in palaces. They give birth slowly. We can get there. But... The Hebrews, man, they're stout and sturdy. We can't even get there. And apparently he's like, oh, okay.
I guess. It made me wonder, you know, he can't. I'm just describing the picture in my head.
Yeah.
But he can't go kill these.
Yeah, my suspicion would be God is at work.
Kind of like right? with Abimelech.
Yeah, that's right. The women fear him, and so he makes it work out. Like, he's going to. There may be a fair amount of truth in what they're saying.
Right.
That is logical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think God's kind of buttressing their take on it. He's helping them out.
Like when he told Abimelech, I didn't let you.
Yeah, that's right.
You know.
God's behind the scenes. In fact, that's one of the things about Exodus in comparison with Genesis. Even though there is quite a bit of direct interaction from God in the book of Genesis, there's even more in Exodus. You're going to see, he's going to reveal himself strongly in this book. God takes a lot of action here. It's a great book for learning the character of God. Very good book for that.
Well, and I'm starting to pick up, Bob, you know, that the blessings, you know, as Moses describes the families. The blessings really first are in people and numbers of people rather than you don't hear the blessings being talked about in wealth terms, like he had all this gold.
No, they're multiplying. That's right. Large family. Like the blessing for the midwives. That's a great point, Jamie.
Yeah.
The blessing for the midwives, it specifically says in the text, was God gave them a family.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's
yeah, I got to say this. I'm stepping outside of the text now, but you'll know what I'm talking about. You know, my wife is from the Philippines. They've got large families over there. You know, I grew up with three siblings, but Kathy is one of nine.
Wow.
And, you know, a difficult life in the Philippines. It's not, mm-hmm. not quite like living here. Their parents worked very hard to raise nine children and so on. And, you know, over here you might ask someone, you know, are you prepared for your later years? And what we mean by that is, you know, do you have an IRA?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how's your retirement account and so on? One day I was talking with Kathy's mom, and she said, you know, my investment is my children.
Wow.
That's my retirement account, is what she was saying. And it's very much like that. They look after their parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the children has died, but the remaining eight, you know, very concerned for their parents' welfare, and that is their retirement. Their kids look after them. You know, people are the investment. And we've lost that to some extent in Western culture. You know, we're so concerned with the material world that, you know, our families are smaller. And
well, that was one of the first blessings that God talked about, was about multiplying, be fruitful and multiply. And as
right.
you pointed out earlier, we read it again here, and then seeing it with the midwives again, you know, if we didn't know this part of the story and we were just New Testament readers, you know, we'd miss one of the core blessings that we have as God's children.
That's right, your seed, your
mm-hmm.
offspring, your family. And also it's happening in the midst of, remember in Genesis 1, God was creating out of the midst of chaos. He was overcoming chaos.
Right.
And you have just similar details, right? The Hebrews are at just incredible hard labor that's
right,
stressed,
right.
And they're multiplying like rabbits in the midst of this chaos. They've got a Pharaoh trying to kill them, and they barely have a moment's rest, and they're still multiplying. It's God fulfilling his plan even in the midst of chaos. It's the same kind of picture.
Yep. Onward, my friend.
Well, what else is there in chapter 1? You did a great job of pointing out the fear of God, and that really is a gigantic takeaway as far as application from this chapter for any of God's people down through any age. Fear God,
mm-hmm.
not the worldly powers. Fear him.
A healthy fear.
That's right. Do what's right. So how about if we read chapter 2?
Okay.
Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket, covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what had happened to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. She had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then her sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's daughter. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, said, "Because I drew him out of the water." Now it came about in those days, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his brethren and looked on the hard labors and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And he went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. He sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them, watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" So they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. What is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I've been a sojourner in a foreign land." Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. The sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage. They cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them.
So, as you pointed out, it definitely paints the same picture for me as the Herod story. You know, that trying to wipe out a race in a sense and you know, just, you know, graft them into your...
Yeah, it's the seed of the serpent versus the seed of the woman. Just like Cain killing Abel, and here's the serpent, you know, trying to kill the seed of the woman.
And Moses out of the house of Levi.
That's right, he's a Levite. That's foreshadowing. That's going to be huge in the story because they're going to become the priestly tribe. So Moses is a Levite.
And I think it really illustrates, as you were talking in chapter 1, plan A, God's plan.
That's right. How about this? So really this chapter, you know, the two biggest things going on in this chapter is foreshadowing for what's going to happen in the future. And then also looking back on what's happened in the past. So Moses is the focal point. Okay, he's now taking over the story. So when you have him described, verse 3, "But when she could hide him no longer," this is Moses' mom, "she got him a wicker basket, covered it over with tar and pitch. She put the child into it, set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile." That's reminiscent of Noah, explicitly, right? The ark was described as being covered with pitch and tar, just like this basket. And actually, the word, they've translated that basket. It's actually the word ark.
Really?
So that Moses is in this ark on the Nile, right? In the forces of chaos, right? The Nile River that Pharaoh runs. So he's being pictured as like a Noah who delivered humankind, you know, out of God's destruction. And so here's Moses, you know, this baby at this point, and he's going to deliver Israel through the Red Sea, right? And they're going to come out safely, very much like Noah. So he's pictured that way. And then, you know, the foreshadowing, when he... you know, for instance, helps the girls, you know, as they want to water the flock. He does it, right? He defends them. He chases off whoever the shepherds are by himself,
right?
And then waters their flock. Okay, so as you read forward in the book of Exodus, what are the people going to be saying as they come out of Egypt? man, we're thirsty. You know, we're gonna, Moses is going to bring water, right? So they, it's all
for the whole
backshadowing
flock.
And then foreshadowing. You know, so it's just the echoes in this chapter are just resounding.
Well, and how gracious that Moses gets found by the Egyptian princess and reunited with his mom.
Yeah,
for pay.
Yeah, in other words, that's that's exactly right, Jamie. That's great reading because biblically, again, in Hebrew narrative, and you'll see this in other literature as well, but this is irony. The Bible is so ripe with irony because the ultimate author of the scriptures is God. Mm-hmm. And really the definition of irony is a conflict in point of view. So you're consistently presented in the Bible with God's point of view, which is so different than the fallen human point of view. You know, how ironic. Moses' mom is going to get paid to nurse him.
Right.
Which she would have done anyway. But here's Pharaoh. This is out of Pharaoh's own household. This is Pharaoh's daughter paying Moses' mom to nurse him.
Based on Pharaoh's rules.
Yeah. So it's all, you know, God's in control of the whole thing. And it ends up being so ironic.
Almost like it reminded me of the story, Joseph's story as well, you know.
Yes.
God means it for good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's something important for all of us to realize, even in our own lives, with our own struggles, that
God means it for good. He's in control of everything, which is a great takeaway for us in the midst of the cosmic battle. As we read this story, it would be so easy to conclude, like, say you were one of Pharaoh's daughter's maidens, mm-hmm. and you're watching this happen. You don't see anything supernatural.
No.
And it's all supernatural. God's controlling the whole thing. But there's another side to that coin in that he's not doing it robotically.
No.
You know, it's not like he's got this master control panel and he's going to make Pharaoh's daughter say this or... He is so sovereign that he uses our own free will mm-hmm. to accomplish his plan A all along. So take encouragement from that, that every moment of your life is in his hands. He's controlling that whole thing.
Now, the murder that comes up, you know, in... passages in the past, you know, Lamech, Cain, the murderer, not well looked upon. But in this case, or in this instance, it wasn't just part of Moses's, you know, just, what was it?
Well, that's a great question, and that's really not something I could resolve, even within myself, nor for you or a listener. God is going to turn out to be pretty powerful dude mm-hmm. in this book. I mean, we've seen him at the flood, but he's going to wipe out a bunch of people. Right. And Moses is kind of doing the same, you know, as mm-hmm. far as he could humanly do it.
Right.
And what mitigates that is the context of what Pharaoh's trying to kill these guys.
Right.
And the person that Moses killed was killing a Hebrew.
Right.
So it's not like that guy was, Moses just picked someone off the street and murdered him. Right? This was a guilty individual to begin with. I'm not excusing the violence. I'm just saying, given the context of what's going on, this is war between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, and that's right. How they're acting.
Kind of the
and I just leave it at that. God is very opposed to murder. He hates violence. You know, strong laws about that. Well, right? Death penalty for killing somebody. However, he can do the same. You know, if you push him too far, he can do that.
Question. So, when... You were talking about the daughters that he helped feed the flocks. And they recognized him as an Egyptian.
Yeah.
They didn't say a Hebrew. They didn't say an Israelite.
His attire
was Egyptian.
It was Egyptian.
So then in a sense, or not in a sense, or what Moses putting down here is that he is an Israelite. Is that?
Yes, that's right. Because the question to the, this guy was raised in Pharaoh's household.
Mm-hmm.
He had the best school, you know, which is nothing to write off lightly. Moses is a very accomplished guy, being brought up in Pharaoh's household. And those are the guys that built the pyramids long before Moses' time. They're very skilled in a lot of things. Reading, writing, engineering, craftsmanship. The Egyptian culture's almost never been surpassed in my mind. So Moses is a very accomplished guy.
Within their system.
Yes, but he considers himself Hebrew.
Yeah.
He knows who he is.
And I kind of got a sense, you know, as I was trying to piece together this murder in my mind, that's what he was trying to let the reader know, was that, hey, you know, that those are my people. And
well, yes, and the New Testament picks this up. Moses is discussed, this part of the story is discussed in the New Testament in two places. In Acts, Stephen's sermon, around chapter 8, and in the book of Hebrews. And Stephen, I think it's Stephen, will make the point, Moses thought he was delivering Israel at that point.
Huh.
So it's kind of interesting.
Huh.
You know, the fuller story's kind of interesting. Because as we're going to see in the next two chapters, he's going to back off from the whole job that God's going to lay on him. And yet he was already trying to do that on his own.
Right. With unwittingly, in a sense.
But the New Testament makes a point, wittingly he was trying to do it.
Now, who are the Midianites?
We don't know much about them historically. Great question. Some kind of neighbor of Egypt. We don't know exactly geographically where they were, even. We don't know. They've got a priest, though. This guy's priest, and he's... You're going to see him later in the text. He's going to show up, after the Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to show up to Moses, and he's going to help Moses and explain to him how to do some things. And was very glad to hear of Yahweh's deliverance of his people. So it's
very
just kind of interesting.
Right? You know, the recognition that Moses had, even though his daughter said an Egyptian, well, why is he still over there? Go get him.
Yeah, like Reuel, you know, he's actually Jethro. We know his name from later on, which is not uncommon for people in the Old Testament to have a couple different names. Solomon went by a couple different names, mm-hmm. and so on. So it's not uncommon for him to have a couple different names, but Reuel, he's like friend of God. So what his name means, you know, it's kind of interesting.
That's what Reuel means.
Yeah. Which might have been, a generic name at that time, but it's interesting that it's
that's
listed
it
and
means.
That's what it means.
It's almost what was the priest, Melchizedek?
Yeah, Melchizedek. King of Righteousness.
I got kind of that same sense here it was the same.
It's almost a similar character, you know, this...
Yep.
Somewhat mysterious, only mysterious in that Moses just doesn't give you, even though it's his father-in-law, doesn't give you a ton of detail about him.
Right.
Other than he tells you he was a priest, his name is Friend of God, he's going to show up later on and help me out. It's kind of interesting.
Right? So, three other observations that I have on this chapter are towards the end. So, the Israelites, you know, grumbling, sighing, you know, pleading for help.
Yeah.
And their cry, quote unquote, rose up to God.
Yeah.
Okay. Then God remembered his covenant and took notice of them.
Yeah, I tell you, you are becoming such a great reader. If you were to read a commentary, you know, like I've got right here. They're going to give a couple pages on exactly what you just said. They're noticing that too. And in a lot more technical language, but no more so than what you were saying.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. But keep in mind, some of it is just how they would use language. You know, God remembered doesn't mean he forgot.
Well, yeah, that was
God's
my question.
Omniscient. So it's not
that's right. I made a covenant with Abraham.
Oh yeah, what was I thinking? That's not what it means. Okay, it means, you know, remembered, as in is now preparing to act on that. You know, that this was the plan. And he had told Abraham that, right? You guys are going down there.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be there for this length of time and so on, and then I'm going to bring you out. So you say it's not like he forgot. The word remember is not to be taken in that sense. It's to be taken in the sense that now I'm going to make good on this, because this was my promise with Abraham. He's going to be really adamant about that, you know, that I'm going to, in a sense, this is metaphor, but it's the way I see he's going to get up off his throne. He's been sitting there for a while, you know, because he's growing his nation. It's not like he's ever passive. God doesn't take naps. Mm-hmm. He's controlling the whole thing, but you're going to see his hand directly. Whereas you've seen it only behind the scenes, you know, for a few centuries now. He's going to get up. And
well, he's been made that.
If you're a baseball fan, he's going to pick up a bat and stand in the batter's box.
Now, what about the pleas rose up to God? What should we take from that? Because
he hears you.
Right?
He hears you. He is very... You know, what the theologians will do with this is, and God's going to say this later on, he feels, you know how we'll use the phrase, you know, oh man, I feel your pain. He, for us, that's lip service.
Right.
For him, that's real. These are his people. And he does feel their pain. He's going to act.
And that's the took notice of them.
Yeah, and the takeaway is, he feels your pain. You know, we say this in church often, but if you ever were to begin a prayer, even in your own mind, not necessarily the spoken word, but, you know, like, God, do you know what happened to me today? Yes, he does know.
I have to say guilty of that before, Bob.
Well, not guilty, like that's wrong.
Right?
But yes, the answer's yes. He does know. And in fact, not just know about it, he felt that with you. That's what I mean, that this book of Exodus gives great detail into God's character. He's not this removed sovereign. He's not on his throne such that things on earth don't affect him, and he is greatly affected by what his children go through. And all the earth is his. He's affected by everything. It's sort of, I just have to put this in a corner of my mind where I don't have to deal with it, but I don't know how he does that. I don't know how he feels the pain of everyone and is still able to function.
Right.
Just my pain ought to slow him down.
Amen.
But he feels it, and, you know, he can handle that. But he does act on it. He knows your rejection. He knows your sorrow. He knows your loneliness. He knows all of that. And more so, actually. More so. Because he's feeling it from everybody. And by the way, you know, imagine, let's jump forward in the story. No one was as rejected and lonely as Jesus. So, I mean, he knows your pain. And it's time for him to deliver. He's going to make good on that. And at the cost of violence. He is not a violent God, but if he has to do that to deliver his children, he will. It's like a parent.
Sure.
You may very well be a peace-loving, law-abiding guy, but somebody threatens your children, there's no telling what you might do. And justified, right? And God is like that.
Your image, I mean,
that's right.
That is... Our children are our image, you know, obviously created in God's image, and he is their ultimate father. But earthly, they're created in our image. And just as you were saying, when we see our image hurt, we don't like it.
That's right.
Imagine, yeah.
That's right. Anything else on this? I know we're covering these. You know, there's way more in here than we say, but our purpose really, you have to keep moving forward.
Right.
If you slowed down and explained every word in a text, you'd never finish, and it's important that you get through the story. And so we're doing that, tracing the theme of the cosmic battle. So there's tons more we could say about these chapters, but you know, there's other resources out there, and we encourage everybody to read to your heart's content. Here's a good book. The book we use through Genesis was typically, you know, there's actually a lot of them, but the main two that I rely on to prepare for Genesis is a book called Creation and Blessing, I think, by Alan Ross. Alan Ross is definitely the author. It's his commentary on Genesis. And then a book by John Salehammer called The Pentateuch as Narrative. So for the book of Exodus, I would still use Salehammer. He's going to cover all five books of Moses. And then this book is a commentary on Exodus by Terence Fretheim. And so anybody who wants to, you get those books and read to your heart's content. They'll do a great job of explaining some of the things we have to hurry over.
Well, should we close this one up with a prayer before
That's right.
we go on to our next episode?
That's right. Let's do that. Lord, we are prepared to see you in your own words in the book of Exodus in a way that truly expands our knowledge of you. And we pray that as we read those words, and that you put those words in our minds, but bury them in our hearts, that it will transform us into the image of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.
Amen.